Chapter 5. The long black limo pulled into the underground garage and blinked its lights 3 times. It received 2 answering blinks from the opposite end of the garage. Men armed with automatic weapons got out of the limo and took up their positions. When they were satisfied that the area was secure, Carmen got out. With 2 of the men flanking him, he walked out toward the middle of the garage. He frowned when he saw Rick Borodini and 2 of his gunmen coming to meet him. When the 2 groups were about 20 or so yards apart, the gunmen stopped, and Carmen and Borodini continued on alone to meet each other in the center.
"I made some arrangements to meet with your father," Carmen said tersely.
"He couldn't come," said Rick. "So he sent me. I can speak for him."
"I see," said Carmen dryly. "Perhaps I should have sent my secretary to speak for me as well."
Rick did not reply. He simply stood there, his darkly attractive features expressionless, not rising to Carmen's bait. He had the kind of look that made you wonder if there was anybody home, thought Carmen. It would have been very easy to underestimate Rick Borodini. He looked like just another of the city's young swells, a typical example of this new generation New York's Midtown was breeding. More concerned with the cut of their clothes and the style of their hair than with building a new future for the devastated country. The future, so far as they were concerned, began and ended with them. The world their grandparents had built had been wiped away in a matter of mere days. It could just as easily happen again, they figured, so why not live to the hilt while they still had the chance? It could all end tomorrow. However, Rick Borodini was not like that, though he looked the part. Rick was totally committed to the future of the Borodini Empire that he had seen almost destroyed. With the death of his older brother Tommy, whom he had murdered, Rick stood to inherit it all, and he took that very seriously. He was smart, shifty, and as cold as the grave. Of those who had underestimated him, few had lived to tell about it.
"Please tell your father that when I request a meeting with him, I expect him to show up personally," Carmen said. "Not send a family representative, as competent as that representative might be," he added, deciding to throw Rick a bone.
Victor wasn't getting any younger, and given the frequently unstable dynamics of the crime families, Carmen knew that Rick might well wind up in control of the family before too long. It wouldn't do to alienate him.
"I'll pass on the message," Rick said flatly.
"I've been meaning to tell you. That was a first-class job you did the other day," said Carmen. "Efficient and brilliantly executed. You're to be congratulated."
Rick merely nodded once. Bastard can't even take a compliment, thought Carmen. What does it take to get a rise out of him? "Where's your button, Rick?" he thought. "I'll find it, and then I'll push it and put you through your paces."
"It's just as well you came," continued Carmen. "I'd like you to do another little job for me."
Rick merely raised one eyebrow and waited.
"There's a journalist, a television news reporter, by the name of Linda Tellerman," Rick nodded. "She's become a problem."
"And you want that problem taken care of," Rick said softly.
"Yes, but in a certain way. Similar to the way you took care of that other little problem."
"You want it to look like Steele did her."
"You seem to have the general idea. The manner of her, demise should be sufficiently dramatic that public sentiment will be suitably outraged at the fact and left with no doubt as to Steele's being psychotic and out of control."
"When do you want it done?"
"Tonight, if you can manage it. I realize it's rather short notice, but you've proven yourself quite resourceful in the past, and I'll make it well worth your while."
"Right. Anything else?"
"Just give my warmest personal regards to your father, Rick."
"I'll do that. Nice talking to you, Senator."
He turned around and walked back to his car. Carmen stared after him for a moment. That son of a bitch is more of a machine than Steele, he thought. But Rick has his uses. Carmen turned around and walked back to his car. It was late, and he had a press conference at noon tomorrow. With any luck, Linda Tellerman would not be there to ask him any awkward questions. It had been a long day, and Captain Jake Hardesty had just settled into a nice hot bath when the phone rang. He was tempted not to answer it, but a phone call this late at night usually meant police business. He swore and got out of the bath, slipped on his terry robe, and answered the call on the 5th ring.
"Hardy! Majesty,
he said.
Jake, it's steel,
said the Matrix.
Jesus Christ,
said Hardesty.
Jake, I know what you're thinking, but I didn't kill those men, and I can prove it.
How?
The dispatcher's tapes. You still have them, don't you?
Yeah, of course I still have them. They're on permanent record. You know that.
Run a computer voice print analysis on them, Jake. You'll find that the call supposedly made by Steve Jernigan in Unit 12 and the call that came from Unit 21 were both made by the same man. And it wasn't Jernigan or Marshak or Coblins. It was Rick Borodini.
Hardesty sat down on the bed.
Borodini? How do you know this?
Just trust me, Jake. No, better yet, don't trust me. Find out for yourself. You may not have a recording of Rick Borodini's voice, but run that voice print analysis on those tapes and ask yourself how the same man could have made those calls from two different units. That code 13 never came from Steve Jernigan. Both Jernigan and Pastorelli were already dead. Most likely, so were Marshak and Coblins. Borodini must have ambushed them and taken the cruisers, set up the scene, and staged the whole thing using the radio from one of the units.
How do you know it was Borodini?
I heard the tapes, Jake. Don't ask me how. I can't explain, but I'm capable of doing a computer voice print analysis. I found out that the calls from Unit 12 and Unit 21 were both made by the same man. Then I scanned my memory of all the voices that I'd ever heard, looking for a match. The voice print matched Rick Borodini's. You have to take my word for it, Jake. Check it out yourself. Compare the prints of those calls against the calls those men made previously. You'll find that they don't match.
I will check it out myself, said Hardesty. But I believe you. I questioned Donna Barrett this evening after she did that interview. And even though she can't prove it, I believe you were with her when those men were killed. But until now, I couldn't for the life of me explain those calls.
I couldn't either, Jake,
the Matrix said.
At least not until I ran those voice prints.
You're saying that Carmen's tied up with the Borodini family?
Said Hardesty.
It certainly looks that way,
the Matrix replied.
I'll tell you a few more things about Carmen while I'm at it. His financial assets are a real maze, but a lot of his money simply seems to come from out of nowhere.
You're saying Victor Borodini owns him?
Hardesty asked with disbelief.
They're in bed together, but not even Borodini has that kind of money. Carmen's taking his orders from some sort of organization. I haven't been able to learn precisely what it is yet, but they've been putting pressure on him to settle by hash once and for all and to get rid of Jennifer Stone. They say she knows too much. Whoever they are, they're at the Project Download. Higgins and the agency stood in the way, so they used Carmen to get rid of him.
Wait a minute,
Hardesty said.
How the hell do you know all this?
Just good old-fashioned police work, Jake. And I've been monitoring Carmen's calls.
You got his phone tapped?
Hardesty said with astonishment.
How in the hell did you manage to do that?
I can't tell you that, Jake. Let's just say I have my methods.
Christ! You realize I can't use any of this, don't you? Even if you've got Carmen on tape saying something to implicate himself, it's useless. It's an illegal wiretap.
I know that, Jake. And Carmen's very careful about what he says on the phone. But you can run the voice print analysis on those tapes to prove those men never made those calls. And I can provide you with a file of my investigation into Carmen's finances, confidential records, corporate filing statements, secret accounts, blind holding companies, the works. Hook up your modem after we're done. I'll call you back in 10 minutes and let you have it. Maybe that won't bring him down, but it'll start the ball rolling. It'll raise a lot of questions he won't be able to answer.
How the hell did you get your hands on all that stuff? No, on the other hand, don't tell me. If I don't know that it was obtained illegally, maybe I can find a way to use it.
Just make sure you take steps to protect yourself, Jake. Carmen's a very powerful man.
Don't I know it? Jesus, if we can prove that the White Knight's corrupt, it'll blow this whole city wide open. He's got just about every local bureaucrat and politician in his pocket. But I'm afraid that none of that is going to help you, Steele. I can't get the warrants on you lifted. Even if we can prove that you were framed for killing those four cops, you still confessed to shooting down that chopper and killing those three marshals who were aboard. And you're still wanted for resisting arrest and a whole shitload of other charges stemming from that.
I know that, Jake. That's why I can't come in. But maybe if I can bring Carmen down, I can prove mitigating circumstances.
Providing you'll get that chance,
says Hardesty.
According to the strict letter of the law, you're not entitled to a trial!
I know that too, but if somebody told me not so very long ago, I'll just have to concentrate on one thing at a time. Right now, I'm going to concentrate on Carmen and the Borodinis. I've got a lot of old scores to settle with them.
Look! I don't know where you are, and I don't want to know, said Hardesty. But if that information's as good as you said, then with that and the voice print analysis, I can probably get that order for you to be shot on sight canceled. I don't know. I'm getting a lot of pressure from upstairs. But if I got something solid to back them off with, I might be able to take some of the heat off of you. But I can't make any promises.
I understand that, Jake, and I appreciate it. But just remember what I said about taking steps to protect yourself. Carmen's a dangerous enemy.
Yeah, said Hardesty. Well, so am I. Take care of yourself, Steel, and be careful.
I will, Jake, and thanks.
Hardesty hung up the phone and exhaled heavily. God damn, he thought. If even half of what he had just heard was true and he could prove it, a lot of people in this town were suddenly going to find themselves with their asses hanging way out in the breeze. And they weren't going to like it one bit. They'd all get together and come down on him like a ton of bricks, both officially and behind the scenes. He'd probably wind up with a contract out on him as well. That was the least of his concerns. He'd had people try to kill him before. That came with the territory. But when it came to political infighting, he was a rank amateur. When Bryce Carmen snapped his fingers, the governor, the mayor, the city council, the police commissioner, and the chief all started hopping about like Mexican jumping beans. What Steele said he had on Carmen sounded as if it could be very damaging, but unless Carmen was caught standing over a dead body with a smoking gun in his hand, Hardesty didn't think much of his own chances of surviving the fallout. A lesser man might have chosen to keep his head down unless he had something with which to nail Carmen cold, but they didn't call Jake Hardesty hard-ass for nothing. He still had about 10 minutes before Steele called him back. Hooking up the modem only took a second. What he needed now was a good lawyer, someone who had no political ambitions. That scratched well over half of the lawyers in the city. Someone sharp and quick and shifty, who could anticipate every dirty trick in the book, and some that hadn't even been invented yet. Someone who didn't give a shit about the system, who thrived on bucking it. Someone on the fringe, who wasn't afraid of Carmen and the big wheels in city politics, and who wouldn't be intimidated. Someone meaner than a junkyard dog. Jake knew exactly who to call. There was someone. Someone who fitted the bill perfectly. Someone who would be absolutely shocked to hear from him. He took his address file out of his nightstand and flipped through it, then picked up the phone and dialed.
Sharky! Jake Hardesty! Yeah, that's right! Yeah, I know what time it is, so shut up and listen! I need a lawyer! No, I'm not kidding! I'm about to step into a pool of shit that's about 100 feet over my head, and I'm asking you to jump in with me! No, I didn't blow away some helpless unarmed kid! Just shut up and listen! This is privileged communication, all right? Okay, then. I'm about to take on City Hall and the entire federal government! I've got evidence that Steele was framed in the shooting of those four police officers! And I have reason to believe that the Borodini family was involved, acting on the instructions of Senator Bryce Carmen. And I've got access to Carmen's personal financial records. Never mind how, which will implicate him in the biggest corruption scandal to ever hit this city. Yeah, holy shit, it's right. I need someone to keep them from cutting me off of the knees. And if the Borodinis are involved, you realize what that means. I'll provide you with police protection, but... Come on, Sharky, for Christ's sake, don't be an ass. If you take this on, you could get yourself killed. We're talking about some very heavy people here. What? Yeah, I'm at home. What now? No, you're right, I guess we shouldn't talk about this on the phone. Okay, I'll get dressed and put on a pot of coffee. What the hell's so damn funny? Yeah, right, I remember. And I still think that's what you are, but it happens to be exactly what I need right now. Yeah, well, fuck you, too! And Sharky! Thanks!
I'll say this much for Steele,
Andy said as they pulled up.
He's consistent! This is even worse than the last place he set up a meeting! Battery Park at 4 o'clock in the morning!
He shook his head.
Jeez, why not the Bronx, for God's sakes? That would have been safer. Tell me something. Why the hell did I stay at Channel 7?
Linda kept the engine running. She lit up a cigarette.
Because I got News 4 to offer you more money. Now stop bitching and keep your eyes open and have your rig ready. I want you ready to roll as soon as we spot him.
I'd rather have my ordnance ready,
Andy replied nervously. He unsnapped the safety strap on his .45 semi-auto and glanced down toward the kit bag at his feet. In addition to his usual tools and spare videotapes, it contained a 9mm machine pistol, a short pistol-gripped pump shotgun, and Baby, Linda's Strike Force battle rifle. There were plenty of spare ammo clips and shotgun shells.
Christ! Look at all this stuff! He said. Why don't we just join the cops and have done with it? At least they got armored cruisers.
You're the one who's worried about being undergunned last time, she said. We've got ourselves enough firepower now to take on a whole street gang by ourselves. I figured that would make you feel a little more at ease.
I'd be more at ease back home in bed, said Andy, behind locked and barricaded doors. Jesus, look at this. We're right out in the open.
Which will make it easier for us to see anybody coming, Linda replied. Will you relax for crying out loud? Here, have some more coffee.
No thanks. I'm wired enough as it is.
He glanced around nervously.
You realize we could get surrounded here? They'll get in front of us. There's nowhere for us to go except to drive into the river.
Who's they?
Street gangs, homicidal derelicts, psychopathic screamers. Who the hell knows? Nobody in their right mind comes here during the daytime, much less at 4 a.m.
You're making me crazy, she said. Here, have a cigarette.
I don't smoke.
Well, start.
He took a cigarette out of the pack and gazed at it, wrinkling his nose.
Hell, why not? This kind of places you take me to, cancer should be the least of my worries.
He lit up, took a drag, and coughed.
Ah, Jesus! How the hell can you smoke those things?
She ignored him as she continued to stare out through the windshield. It was black as pitch out there. The only illumination came from their headlights.
You really think he'll show?
Asked Andy.
He called and said he would.
He's really going to do it? He's actually going to turn himself in?
That's what he said.
How did he sound?
I don't know. I didn't talk to him. Andrea took the call. Apparently, he didn't sound too good. She said he sounded hoarse and was breathing heavily. Said he'd been shot, but he didn't give any details.
So they really got him? Damn, I was starting to think that nothing could stop him.
Armor-piercing bullets could, said Linda grimly. I just hope he's not too badly hurt, but I guess it would have to be pretty bad to make him give himself up.
Donovan Steele surrenders to News 4 reporter Linda Tellerman, said Andy. Film at 11. The management of Channel 7 will be chewing on their elbows.
It'll serve them right, too, Linda said. Those chicken shit bastards. I'm going to blow them right out of the water with the ratings on this story. As soon as we pick up Steele and bring him to the studio, we're going to on the air live with a special report.
At 4 a.m, who the hell's going to be watching?
They'll be watching. Even if it's nobody but the jerks at Eyewitness News, that'll be enough. They'll be promoting the story all through the night, and Rob's got me on the morning show. After we run a full feature at noon, 6 and 11. After this, I'm going to make him let me anchor the 6 o'clock news broadcast. I'll bury those bastards at Channel 7.
What do you think they're going to do to Steele? Or don't you care?
She gave him a sharp glance.
That was low, Andy.
He's giving himself up to you because he trusts you,
he replied.
He thinks you care what happens to him.
I do care what happens to him. God damn it.
Yeah, and me fooled. All you've been talking about is what this story's going to mean to your career. You've hardly said a word about what will happen to Steele. By now, he might even be dead for all we know.
He isn't dead. He can't be.
Yeah, that would ruin your exclusive, wouldn't it?
Fuck off, Andy. In case you've forgotten, my career certainly hasn't hurt yours any. Any idiot could operate a minicam. Keep that in mind.
Yes, ma'am.
Shit. Where the hell is he? What's keeping him? Wait a minute. Look over there.
A figure came shambling toward them out of the darkness.
Is that him? I can't tell.
Could be anybody,
Andy said, glancing down toward his shotgun.
Could be a screamer.
If it was a screamer, he'd be running toward us and howling at the top of his lungs, Linda said. I think it's him. He looks hurt. Yes, it's him. He's waving. Come on, get out of the car and start rolling.
As they got out of the car and Andy shouldered the minicam, the dark figure coming toward them stumbled and fell.
He's hurt,
shouted Linda. Andy noticed that she glanced at him quickly to make sure that he was rolling before she started running towards Steele. He followed, walking quickly, keeping the camera as steady as he could. Linda was ahead of him. She reached the fallen man and crouched down. Then Andy felt a powerful blow that knocked him right off his feet. He dropped the camera as he fell flat on his back, stunned. He struggled up to a sitting position, bringing his hand to his chest. It came away wet with blood.
Fuck, he said with surprise. I'm shot.
There was a sharp popping sound, and the next bullet struck him in the head. Charmaine, Sharky, Powers was a tall, slim, attractive, and very leggy black woman with her hair cropped close to her scalp, exotic features, and large, intelligent, almond-shaped eyes that were almost, but not quite, Asian-looking. She had earned her nickname in the whirlpools of the judicial system, and more than a few prosecutors and arresting officers bore evidence of her tooth marks. Had she wanted to, she could easily have found a niche with one of the top law firms in the city, but instead she chose to have her own practice, defending those who needed it most, and who could afford to pay the least. Often, Sharky took on clients for nothing, because they had nothing. She represented the poor people of the city and the disenfranchised citizens of no man's land. Her clients included the guilty as well as the innocent. Among them were gang members, pimps, prostitutes, drug dealers, thieves, armed robbers, muggers, rapists, and murderers. As passionately committed as she was to seeing that the poor were represented, she was equally committed to making the system toe the line. Hardesty knew that if any of his officers busted a rapist or a murderer, they damn well better be sure it was a good bust, because if they fucked up anywhere along the line and Sharky was defending, the son of a bitch would walk. The moment she entered a courtroom, the gloves were off, and her job was to slug it out with the prosecution and go for blood, even if it meant letting some scumbucket get off. Because the alternative, as she saw it, that of a police state that did not have to account to its citizens for every single action that it took, and justify down to the last minute detail its power to infringe upon their liberties, was far more frightening than 1,000 murderers and rapists running around loose. There had been times when Sharky had admitted that she'd been glad to lose a case, because the prosecution had proven its case irrevocably, beyond the faintest scintilla of a doubt, and Sharky was not above feeling an intense personal loathing for some of her clients. But she made the prosecutors fight for their convictions all the same. The cops hated her guts, but they respected her. Hardesty watched her as she sat down at his kitchen table, looking over the material Steele had sent over the modem. She was not dressed the way he usually saw her, in her severe yet tasteful courtroom attire, but in faded blue jeans, running shoes, and a dark green turtleneck sweater. Its looseness hid the small 9mm semi-auto she wore in a clip holder on her belt.
Damn,
she said in a deep voice as she finished looking over the material.
Looks like the White Knight has got himself some dirty underwear. How'd you get this stuff?
Don't ask,
said Hardesty.
I have to ask, Jake. There's no way you could have come by most of this stuff legally. Some of it, maybe, if you knew where to look, but the rest of it...
She shook her head.
You must have yourself one hell of a hacker. You had to have cracked some of the tightest security codes around to get most of this. There's no way you're going to be able to use any of it.
Not even if it came from an anonymous source!
You're getting in a very hazy legal area there,
she said.
And the problem is, you know it didn't come from an anonymous source. You won't be able to testify that it did without committing perjury, and I can't allow that.
So you're telling me it's useless?
No, I didn't say that. I said you wouldn't be able to introduce it as evidence because it was illegally obtained. But there's nothing to prevent you from pursuing an investigation from what you've learned from this material, so long as the material itself isn't used as part of the case you build. But then again, you'd have to justify your warrants. And good luck getting warrants that'll give you access to most of this stuff.
So then we're back to square one!
Said Hardesty, frustration evident in his tone.
Not necessarily. Maybe we can't use this stuff in a court of law, but we can use it in the court of public opinion. We could give it to the press, anonymously, of course.
You've got a devious mind, counselor,
said Hardesty, with a smile.
Well, you're not out to bust Carmen for being corrupt,
she said.
You just want to keep him off your back. Give this stuff to the media, and Carmen's going to have his hands full. Meanwhile, if you can prove he was involved in framing Steele for those cop killings, you'll have him on a much heavier rap than any of this will give you.
Yeah, if I can prove it,
Hardesty replied.
In the meantime, he'll try to have my badge.
Let me worry about that. We can't stop them from leaning on you, but if they try to fire you without just cause, I'll hit them with everything I've got, and we'll let them know that in advance. The first time they start putting pressure on you, I'll tell the mayor and commissioner that if they try to lift your badge, I'll go straight to the media and drop some hints that it might have to do with recently uncovered information that has led to an investigation of corruption at the highest levels of the city government.
I hate the idea of fighting my battles in the press,
Hardesty said sourly.
It's called hardball, Jake. You're playing with the heavy hitters now. Carmen doesn't think twice about using the media whenever it suits his purposes. Neither do the mayor or the commissioner. If you try to play this strictly by the book, they'll blow you right out of the water.
Okay, I guess we'll play it your way. So what's our first step?
Your first step is to get over to Strike Force headquarters right away and get your hands on those dispatcher's tapes.
What? Right now?
Yes, right now.
But
nothing. If it occurred to Steele to run voice prints on those tapes, then it could occur to someone else as well. And those tapes could wind up accidentally getting a race. You get my drift? What Steele did is inadmissible. You'll have to run your own analysis on those tapes so we can use it. Go through some of the earlier tapes. Try to find ones with Jernigan, Passarelli, Marshak, and Coblin's voices on them, so you can compare them against the tapes on the night of the shootings. In the meantime, I'm going to get this stuff over to some friends of mine at the Times, and some copies to the TV news as well. The sooner we can get Carmen off balance, the better.
The phone rang.
Hell!
Said Hardesty, glancing at his watch. It was almost morning.
Doesn't anyone in this town sleep anymore?
He answered the phone.
Hardesty! What?
He exhaled heavily.
Jesus Christ! All right, I'll be right down!
He hung up.
Trouble?
Sharky asked.
Yeah!
Said Hardesty grimly.
Linda Tellerman's been murdered!
Oh my God!
Said Sharky, and Hardesty remembered that they knew each other.
What happened?
I don't know. It seems that Steele, or someone claiming to be Steele, called News 4 earlier tonight and said he wanted to turn himself into Linda. He set up a meeting at Battery Park. That's where they found her and her cameraman, both shot dead.
You don't think that Steele...
Not for a minute,
Hardesty replied.
It's a frame. What do you want to bet those slugs turned out to be 10 millimeters? Just like the ones fired by the gun built into Steele's arm. The media's going to be all over us on this one. I'm going to have to go down there.
I'm going with you.
Sharky, this is police business.
It's a lot more than that, and you know it. I'm coming with you. But first, we're going to stop off and pick up those tapes.
The problem with stealing a car in Midtown was that most people who lived in Midtown did not own cars. Easily stored bicycles, as well as the occasional motorcycle and scooter, had become the predominant form of transportation during the workday. At night, the streets were practically deserted, and the few cars that were in the city were kept locked up in garages, protected by private security. The pre-war days of affordable imports were long gone, and the domestically manufactured cars represented a major investment. Few of them were actually sold in cities like New York, where the cost of living made owning and maintaining one prohibitive. Keeping an automobile in the city was a major headache. The domestic automobile manufacturers in Detroit were building very different products now from the ones that had been sold before the war. The largest portion of their sales went to the suburban and the rural areas. Farm machinery for agro-communes had become tremendously important in these days of chronic food shortages, and the most commonly manufactured vehicle was now a high-horsepower four-wheel drive armored pickup truck, available with a wide variety of weapons options. And they were not cheap. No one manufactured anything like an economy sedan anymore. People now needed something that could get them out of trouble fast, provide some self-defense, and travel long distances over lousy roads reliably. Numerous small businesses had grown up that rebuilt existing older cars for those who could not afford newer products. Old Japanese imports were remanufactured with such objects as bulletproof glass and lightweight body armor. If the customer desired, they could be outfitted with machine guns or small rockets, though such vehicles were prohibited in Midtown. They were often slow, but they were reasonably reliable, providing they had been remanufactured by a reputable concern. More often than not, the vehicles that people could afford were ancient, run-down rust buckets, worn-out American cars, or wheezing little imports, held together by spit and baling wire. Good mechanics who could keep them running, often with improvised home-machined parts, were highly sought after. Of these old relics, the most desirable ones were those that could be hopped up to go fast, since speed was all they had going for them to get their drivers out of trouble. In Midtown, Steele did not have much to choose from. The ideal solution would have been to steal a Strike Force cruiser. They would have the best chance of making it all the way out to the east end of Long Island, and the cruiser would be equipped with armaments to protect them from roving bands of raiders. However, neither the Marshals nor the Strike Force cops were traveling alone anymore. Most of them had started doubling up with other units. They're really afraid of me, thought Steele. It was both a sobering and a dispiriting thought. He had thought of asking Jake for help in securing a Strike Force cruiser, but that would have put Jake way out on a limb, and Steele didn't want to do that. He needed Jake, and he knew that Carmen would use any excuse to have him removed from the command of Strike Force the moment he found out what Jake was doing to help him. By now, the Matrix would have contacted him with that information on the tapes and Carmen. Jake would be taking a big chance helping him, but Steele knew that he would do it. He simply couldn't bring himself to ask Jake to help him steal a car. No, this was something he'd have to do himself. That left him with only one other alternative. He'd have to steal a cab. There were two cab companies in Midtown that operated only within Midtown, under license from the city government. These cars were newer and better maintained than most, but they were armored and consequently slow. They would never be capable of outrunning pursuit from the high-powered police cruisers. At this hour of the night, they were also safely locked up in their garages. That left the gypsies. The gypsy cabs weren't pretty. They were primarily old American cars, battered and abused, gas guzzlers with large engines that were hopped up and lovingly cared for by their owners, since they represented their entire livelihoods. They were short on looks and comfort, with most of the attention paid to the running gear. Some were more reliable than others, which wasn't really saying much. The gypsies operated primarily on the fringes of the Midtown borders and in no man's land. The gypsy drivers had arrangements with the gangs, giving them a cut of their take to avoid being molested, and giving gang members free rides anytime they wanted them. It was the cost of doing business. They were not armored, and their bodywork made most of them look as if they were ready for the crusher, but they were capable of some speed, so it would have to be a gypsy cab. The trouble was, if they could find one at this hour, they would have to find one in a decent state of repair and with a full tank of gas. There wasn't any place to fill up once they left the city, except at the enclaves on Long Island, and they needed to avoid those. Steele had no friends there. The Brood Enclave was another story, but it was all the way out in Montauk. The thought of hijacking a gypsy cab bothered Steele. Most of the gypsy drivers lived in no man's land, and their cabs were their only means of earning a living. And it wasn't much of a living at that. He thought of Ralph Gianelli trying to keep himself and his daughter fed on cans of beans. Taking a man's gypsy cab would be like taking his life savings. He felt lousy about it, but it couldn't be helped. So long as they remained in the city, they were in danger. At the Brood Enclave, he could at least feel secure in knowing that Raven would be safe. Then he'd wait and see if there was anything that Jake could do to clear him. If not, then he'd use the Matrix to go on the air and take his case to the people. But that would be a last resort. He didn't get the media on your side by overriding their broadcasts. However, the first order of business was getting out of the city. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and so far they hadn't seen a single cab out on the streets. They had spent their time moving around on the fringes of Midtown, keeping out of sight as much as possible, ducking Strike Force cruisers and Federal Marshals vehicles. They hadn't had a decent meal in 2 days. Steele was holding up, but Raven was showing signs of strain and exhaustion. She didn't utter a word of complaint, but Steele could see that it was getting to her. She couldn't keep this up, but she wouldn't leave him. He loved her for it, but at the same time, he felt exasperated.
"We're going to have to find some place to hole up for a while," he told her. "We're not getting anywhere, and you're tired. We need some rest, and we need some food."
"I'm okay,"
she said.
"You're not okay. You're worn out."
"Don't worry about me. I can handle it."
"You can barely keep your eyes open."
"I can sleep on the trip out to the island."
"Yeah, if we can ever find a goddamned car. You can never find a cab in this town when you need one."
She grinned.
"It's always that way, ain't it? Come on, let's go. We're bound to find a car sooner or later."
"Maybe we should wait and rest a bit."
"I told you, I'm all right. Now come on, let's keep moving."
They checked both ways, then came out of the storefront and started moving quickly down the cracked and buckled sidewalk. As they turned the corner cautiously, Steele motioned for Raven to stay back. Across the street, parked at the curb, was an ancient Lincoln Continental, painted white, its hood and sides decorated with orange and red flames. The gaudy paint did not hide the car's age, its many dents, or the places where the bodywork had been inexpertly patched. From the way it rocked when the women leaned up against it, it was obvious that the shocks were shot to hell. There were 5 young women, clearly hookers, and 1 man, their pimp, dressed in a long white coat and suit, a wide-brimmed hat, with high-heeled boots and lots of gold chains around his neck. The women were obviously finishing up their night's work, and he was checking their take, making sure that none of them had shorted him.
"I think we just found our transportation," Steele said. "Just pray that jukebox has a full tank of gas. You better wait here."
"No, I'm coming with you."
"Look, don't argue with me, okay? There's no need to take any chances. Besides, you can cover me better from here."
She sighed.
"All right, but watch yourself. Most of these bastards have bodyguards."
"I don't see any."
"They might be in the car. Be careful."
"Relax. This'll be a piece of cake."
He unlimbered his battle rifle and, holding it in front of him, quickly walked out toward the car. One of the women noticed him when he was about halfway across the street and nudged the pimp.
"Don't anybody move," said Steele. "No reason for anybody to get shot."
"What the fuck, man?" said the pimp angrily.
"Hey, I pay protection. If anyone's inside the car, they've got 3 seconds to get out."
"Hey, man, ain't nobody inside. Keep cool, okay? Look here."
The pimp opened the rear door.
"Freeze!"
snapped Steele. The pimp froze.
"Come on, man," he said uneasily. "I ain't no fool, okay? I don't want to get my ass shot off. You want the bread, man, take it. Just stay cool, all right?"
"You can keep your money. I just want the car," said Steele. "Move away."
"My car? Oh, man, you must be shitting me."
"I said move away from the car and nobody will get hurt," said Steele. "Now."
"Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Not my car, man. Look, we can work something out, all right? I got me some fine foxes here."
"I'm not going to tell you again," said Steele. "Now move."
"Steele, look out,"
yelled Raven from across the street. As he spun around, he heard the full auto burst of her assault rifle, followed by a shotgun blast. He saw a man armed with a pump shotgun quickly duck back into a stairwell across the street and cursed himself for not being more careful. The damn pimp was smart. He'd had a guard posted out of sight across the street. The shotgun roared again and Raven returned the fire, taking shelter beyond the wall of the building on the corner. Steele heard a motion behind him and spun back around just as the pimp came up with a small, nickel-plated revolver. The pimp fired at his chest point-blank, 5 shots, staring in astonishment as the bullets had no effect. Suddenly, one of the girls screamed and flung herself on Steele's rifle. The pimp jumped back into the car. Cursing, Steele shoved the hooker away from him and smashed his fist through the car window, grabbing the pimp by the throat just as the engine caught. The other girls ran. Another automatic weapon opened up, and bullets spanged off the roof of the car, inches from Steele's face. He ducked down, keeping a firm hold on the pimp, who mashed his foot down on the accelerator. The car roared off, dragging Steele with it as the second gunman, on the near side of the street, continued firing. Steele hung on to the pimp's throat like grim death, his weight strangling him in the process. The car swerved out of control, jumped the curb, and crashed into a flight of stone steps leading up to a building entrance, climbing halfway up before it stopped. The impact shook Steele loose. Raven was still exchanging gunfire with the first gunman, but now the second one had started concentrating his fire on her as well. She had damn little cover for where she was, and all the second gunman had to do was move down the street, perhaps a dozen yards or so, and he'd have a clear shot at her. The man realized that as soon as Steele did, he started moving. Steele glanced quickly through the car window and saw that the pimp was dead. His neck snapped. He raised his battle rifle over the roof of the car and fired off a burst at the second gunman, but the man ducked down into another stairwell just as Steele fired. Over the sounds of gunfire, Steele heard approaching sirens.
"God damn it!"
he swore. Across the street, at the rate the shotgunner was firing, he'd have to run out of shells very soon. But he'd probably be carrying spares, and he could be covered by the second gunman while he reloaded. What had started out as a simple car theft had turned into a street fight. Steele was worried about Raven, and he could hear the sirens coming closer. He had to take both gunmen out quickly before they ran out of time. He started running across the street at a diagonal, moving at a speed the fastest sprinters in the world couldn't hope to match. The second gunman opened up on him, but Steele's speed threw him, and he failed to track him properly. As Steele drew even with him, he fired his battle rifle on full auto. The round struck the gunman in the chest, hurling him back down the stairwell. He kept moving, and the shotgun blast coming from the other side of the street missed him. He stopped suddenly and brought his rifle around, firing one-handed in the direction of the sound. He heard a scream as the gunman was hit, and then his magazine was empty.
"Raven! Come on!"
he shouted. She was about 30 yards away. She started running toward him across the street. Just then, a Metro police cruiser came screeching around the corner behind her, followed by another unit, their sirens wailing. Raven kept on running. As Steele watched, stunned, everything seemed to shift into slow motion. The machine gun turrets on the lead cruiser opened up. He saw the bullets hit her from behind and rip through her chest, and he saw the surprised look on her face as she fell. It seemed to take forever for her to hit the street, and then she lay there, motionless, in a rapidly spreading pool of blood. He screamed,
"Raven! No!"
And then the cruisers were firing at him. He ran back toward the pimp's car, angled crazily up on the steps leading to the building entrance. He vaulted over the back of the car as bullets slammed into it, and the first cruiser raced past him, then screeched around in a sliding 180-degree turn. The other cruiser had braked to a stop so that they could hem him in from both sides, and he could hear the other sirens coming closer as the backup sped toward them. The laser turret extruded from the gun port in his left hand, and Steele fired, aiming for the gas tank of the first police cruiser as it completed its turn. The beam lanced out, and Steele tracked the cruiser as it came around. The tank exploded, and the cruiser went up in a ball of flame. As the cops in the second cruiser piled out and ran to take up their positions, Steele ran up the building steps and smashed through the front door. He took the steps 3 and 4 at a time, moving as fast as he could until he reached the roof. He smashed through the metal door, giving access to the roof, and glanced down. Strike Force units and federal marshals had arrived. He didn't pause to watch them deploy. In minutes, they would cordon off the block. He ran to the roof's edge and leaped, jumping to the next rooftop. He went from roof to roof, then fired a steel dart into the wall, attached a line to it, and rappelled down the back of a building to the street below. He found a manhole with access to the sewers and pulled it up, then climbed down and replaced the cover behind him. He was now in utter darkness. It was damp. It smelled, and water dripped around him. In a daze, he moved down the tunnel. His optics switched to infrared. But he kept seeing Raven, the bullets punching through her chest, that awful look on her face, and he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that she was dead, and he felt that he had killed her. He stood there in the darkness, feeling as if his entire world had crumbled. Susan Carmody, his daughter Corey, Higgins, Cooper, Ice, and now Raven, all dead because of him. His agonized scream echoed through the sewer tunnel, but there were only the rats to hear him. End of chapter.